CEO Jeff, I'll apologize. Well, that will also be a health care cost driver. It would be mostly a workers' comp, which would not be the topic of this committee. So you'll have to go down to the jobs committee to handle that. Maybe take on a claim. There is a budget available for claims yet. We held on to the targets. My intention today is to take comments from members if they want to offer thoughts. From the public who would like to offer some thoughts. And I'm really flexible about any of that, actually. If members want to offer comments here and propose some amendments or areas we should amend, I'm very open to that. I think we'll do most of our amending tomorrow. If we have some amendments at hand, yes, Mr. Penny gave me one, which I don't understand. So I'd rather understand it first and not spend all your time helping me come to understanding about it. Probably a really good idea. What I'm looking for, in general, though, is as you analyze what's the product that's been putting now known as House File 2438, a little catchy number there, is to consider the words, of course, and I've had this little talk with a number of you already, but the system seems to lend itself well to studying language, since now you have language in front of you, so... for better or worse, there it is. You all wanted language, now you got it. But behind the language, especially drafted the way we've done it, is an intent. The intent, in summary, is to try to create a market in the system in a place that struggles to have a market because the people who are involved aren't like going to a store. Someone else buys a product, somebody else uses a product. It's more like my teenagers in my market, where they want to buy things and I have to pay. And they have a lot of incentives. They just think the money keeps coming. You know, and that's actually not a bad analogy. And so we're trying to find a way to connect these teenagers to what they're getting themselves involved with. That would be the model. But so if we could, that's one of the goals, try to create a market, bring back some of the people who left some years ago and preserve the good things we have, some of the good things about where we've grown to. Also, I'll try to create some more transparency and disclosure. And each group, and just bear in mind that each kind of disclosure and transparency I've attempted to create there and the members here is not appropriate for each person who wants to know something. An employer wants to know way more things about his options than would a consumer, than would a provider. And so, whereas one piece of information might not be something you want everybody should care about, I think it's really important to leave in one group. Like, as I talked to the local doctors one time, it occurred to me that the other ones just know about the evidence-based medicine. That the patients can read it, but it's probably beyond most of their daily experience. But they hoped that the doc would be fully informed on that and would be doing things in the most modern and effective way and, you know, and actually keep the cost in mind. That would be my actually hierarchy, by the way. Some people put the cost first. But, and so as the employer shops on, I'd like him to know, or her, to know how many options there are and which are more established, which are newer, which may be more flexible, which might have higher or lower admin, which have greater covered lives, which are likely to be there 10 years from now. And that's also the part about the disclosure about the professionals, that whether we put malpractice convictions in there or not, I don't really care. But I do think it would be nice to know how many degrees he or she has, how many accreditations and, you know, credentials, how many board certifications, how long they've been in practice, where they went to school, where they grew up. And those are things that I think that the consumers might want to know more about their clinician. I know when I try to refer people to my colleagues across the country, I lean on this little book that tells me when they got out of school where they went and what their techniques might be. That really helps me a lot to make a better referral. And it may actually help as people speak to find providers that would help them out. So those are just kind of generalities. But as you look at the different parts that affect your particular either principal, maybe the person not there, or either the PAL principal or the PLE principal, whichever, as you look at those ideas put out there, the words, that's the idea behind them. And so how do we work from a collection of words to really make a dent in the system to create even better outcomes that are world-class outcomes, we want to get down to world-class prices, because we're in a class by ourselves, and good accessibility and respect for the providers and all that, bring the fund back in medicine for those who are working, et cetera. So you're free to come up and say whatever you'd like. And then if you're, but as you do your homework, I would like you to look beyond the words and give me ideas of how you might reword something and say, this really is, this is something you should work on. Like in the case of the medication management therapy, I think that's just the best thing since sliced bread. I do know on two levels that I wish it were a law to mandate it, but that's not realistic, I don't think, for a couple reasons. One is it won't fly, which is a good reason by itself. But also the plans are working toward that way anyway. And above all, I don't want to cause harm to where plans and other carriers are doing, working in a process to move things along. So also look at it with that in mind. So those are my my thoughts of the day. Did you, there was some handouts left, and I neglected to call your attention to. Thank you. I don't know if I used offered the, I thought some, I've tried to have less than more lately. These are just the new ones here. You clean up my handouts. So the old handouts I have to have read, I don't have them in front of me. Oh, here they are. We got busy with stuff, and so we got done 9 minutes early, so I should have burnt up in a minute and a half with my handouts. So I thought you might be interested in these articles about healthcare spending, how much can we afford? And there was even a letter, there's an article in the paper that referenced, if the price is stupid, why the U.S., why we cost so much more. And there's some good big nets to come out of that. Which conditions arise for the comfort of rise in health spending? And my favorite, my personal favorite, already been pointed out by one of the members of this audience about interpreter services, pay now or pay later. And just a thought, the fiscal note came back on this, on the bill about making this a mandate where the plans get to pay, have the privilege of paying for this very important service. It was a couple million dollars in the state plan alone. And so that makes it difficult to make it a mandate, to be honest. But it does call attention to the reality of the challenge that it presents. And so if it's $2 billion in the state plan, it must be $10 billion or more across the system. And so should providers absorb that or not, or how do you handle it? That's not reasonable for anybody to absorb that, I don't think. So that's just a question that raises. This is about the California hospital publishing, price publishing thing. The bad debt thing is all in our mind about people being forced to bankrupt because of their costs. Healthcare and hiring. One of my key interests, if you haven't picked it up, is to make this more friendly for employers to be able to find information they can find useful as they try to get into the health market. And then this was, let's see if you can tell. And there's a little letter from Dr. Geist about healthcare rationing, which we'll pass that on today. All those people. And then the final, just three articles that were in the weekend's paper. This is a takeoff on the health, with the prices one. Why healthcare in America is so darn expensive. Very interesting, and just so you know, Mr. Gernberger suggested there was $400 billion to reallocate in the healthcare system. There's enough money in the system, he said, loud and clear. I would suggest try to reallocate one of those dollars away from whoever has got one of them, and you'll see that we do have a challenge on our hands, and part of it's based upon this article. Health tools on the web, this is an article in I think Sunday's paper in the Tribune about other many sites available and beneficial to you, maybe you know about them all. But the more you can make stuff available on the web, tying to the Minnesota Health Info website, where there used to be links if they're not already there, it can become a sought-after destination for people. And it will draw the funds it needs to keep itself lean and current and enlightening to people who want to find benefit. And then the last is about obesity in hospitals. There's obesity is expensive, especially as I mentioned, the bypasses, and that's there for you. Remember, this still is an honors course, and the final exam's coming sooner or later. With that being said, are there any comments members want to make about anything you've done so far, or any specific questions about the bill or clarification? If not, I'm going to ask for people in the audience to come up after that, but we can. Mr.
Plus, I think I'd rather hear from folks first.
All right. Do you have a list, or are we just going would someone in the audience like to come up and give us their thoughts about the bill? This is your chance. I see a member from the audience.
I
Hi, please introduce yourself, and you're limited to 1 hour in your comments, so we have to get out of here. I think that they lock the building at midnight.
So. I have to first, Mr. Chair.
I think on Wednesday you get 3 minutes, but today you...
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Bruner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The council is a trade association for the 8 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. I appreciate the chance to be here this afternoon to talk about House File 2438. I might have a nice ring by file number 2. There are a number, first of all, we want to commend you for taking on the breadth that you have in trying to pull this together. If the resolution of health care costs was an easy issue, you'd have a nice short bill and there would be a silver bullet, and it wouldn't be the tremendous challenge that it is. So we know that you've done a lot of research, put a lot of hard work into this, and we particularly commend the approach that you're taking of trying to put more information out for the public to have access to. We think that that is definitely the direction that we want to go. I hope that my references to articles and sections remained appropriate with the new the bill as introduced, and if it doesn't, I apologize and maybe a version off. But
yeah. Let me just clarify, the bill as introduced reflects the changes that I made as the authors at the table, and the things we took out, and the same authority is out altogether, except for that exception. I think it's as we talked about, so we thought it'd be cleaner to have the stuff taken out. So
great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's all I know.
In Article 1, you have a section on health plan innovation and regulation, and Section 3 talks about no prior authorization for small charges. Our opinion is this probably isn't a necessary section because plans do virtually no prior authorization just on the basis of cost. The prior authorization criteria tend to be multifaceted, and so we believe that this is a section that is probably not necessary, and probably from the perspective of the plans doing prior authorization change practice a lot, because that's not the criteria that they use singly. In the area of voluntary purchasing pools, the plan had a fair amount of experience with voluntary purchasing pools, and it's the opinion of the industry that they don't work particularly well. Small pools are really attractive until people start needing health care services. Costs go up, and then there's a lot of exiting of it. And so that's something that we've talked a lot about, we've examined a lot over the years, and they have not proved to have the benefit that I think people at least had hoped for at some point. I know that there are individuals representing some of the plans who, if you wanted to talk more about that, would be in a better position than I am to expound on. So, Section 8, on disclosure related to administrative efficiency. We think that this is absolutely consistent with the direction that you're going for disclosure, and we support the section. We do, however, want to point out that this information is currently available. And I apologize, I have a report with my materials. Already is available through the Minnesota Department of Health Health Economics website. And so, Mr. Chair has it.
Yeah.
In any case, we would want to see a duplication here. Also, I wanted to add that most of the plans have also developed cost calculators on their websites. So if you are an enrollee of a particular plan and you go to the secure website, for instance, the health plan that I'm enrolled in keeps track of all my expenditures on the website. It's secure and only I can get that information. But they also have a cost calculator that's available on the website. And most of the plans are doing that right now. So I think there's a great deal of work that has been going on to support sort of creating that information basis that you're talking about, Mr. Chair. Moving on to Article 2, public health care, and health care providers. Section 7 talks about evidence-based health care guidelines and quality improvement, and we are absolutely in support of the direction that you're going around the use of evidence-based guidelines, and we support the elimination of the June 30th, 2006 sunset for this section. One of the things that we're concerned about here is the direction to permit health-related licensing boards to establish practice standards for treating patients within their respective scopes of practice. We would prefer that a more independent, perhaps a nonprofit healthcare organization, not like the Institute for Clinical System Improvement, ICSI, that is dedicated to specifically working on guidelines, be where these things would come from. But the use of the guidelines and the availability of the guidelines for the public to look at is something that we absolutely endorse. Article 2, Section 10, I believe, is on information to be posted on the agency website. We support this effort. It's not dissimilar to what a lot of the health plans have available right now. And I think, Mr. Chair, that you have talked a little bit about having the state use a lot of links so that a lot of what is already out there and available that are not the secure sites is something that will be easy to link up. And finally, in Article 3, you've got a lot of studies in there, Mr. Chair. I worked in state agencies for a lot of years, and I used to look at study language and bills differently than I do right now. What I would say right now is that we look forward to learning the results of a lot of these studies, because there are some things that I think really merit delving into some, and we would be interested in working with a variety of the efforts that are going on that particularly impact the health plans and the quality of care that's being delivered. Those are my comments, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Let me ask you about the studies thing, and then I'll take questions. Just so you know, and there's a lot of ideas here, and I don't think we can do them all by the time May 23rd comes. There'll be time now if we hang around here. Just a joke. But if, you know, I kind of see this as more of a group effort than is probably customary, but if the people in the audience at the table as well would look at the ideas that are there and help me rank them, if we have so many dollars to do something, or if someone else could do it, or it's been done already somewhere else, we don't need to redo it. But these are things I thought needed to be dealt in some more by somebody. Yeah, so that's it. Any questions from Gibson, help me?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Bruner, back to the health-related board's practice standards on page 4. Have you given any thought or heard any discussion about changing the ways in which we license and relicense providers to, instead of using continuing education credits, which most people believe don't work, look at how they practice their particular profession?
Just for
I asked that question so that the MMA lobbyist, well, his pressure was, blood pressure was getting a little low, so I thought I'd ask the question.
Ms.
Bruner.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sure
perhaps you would like the MMA to answer that question. Actually, I mean, I've heard and read a few things. I don't really sort of know what direction this is going. What I would tell you, just for your information, is that we've been working with the Medical Association, taking a look at the whole credentialing requirements that exist. There's an incredible amount of redundancy that goes on, particularly for physicians. And individuals who need to be credentialed and having to interact individually with the health plans and with hospitals where they have privileges. And we've been working very hard over the last couple of months to try to come up with some very solid ideas for doing some really major streamlining of that for physicians. Now, that's different than the point that you made through me for the MMA, but I just wanted to sort of leave that with the committee as well.
Thank you. Other questions, members?
Where were you, Representative Huntley? You said page 4.
Page 4, that was something that they were talking about health-related boards and practice standards. And my contention is that we ought to look at the way we license and relicense providers to actually look at the way they practice in their profession rather than simply ask them how many continuing ed credits they got. And there are some countries that do that, by the way.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Senator.
I'm interested in, I'm sorry, I was trying to half here as we were trying to figure out where you were at, Representative Huntley, but I'm generally in agreement with that. So, look at that.
Well, the phone's ringing. Mr. Renner, why don't you come up and do your thing? You can come to it.
Mr. Chair, members, Dave Renner of the Minnesota Medical Association. We represent physicians throughout the state, about 10,000 members. Before I get some comments on the bill, I just maybe in response to some of these issues, I think you'd probably find agreement on some positions that the way we do it may not be the best way. I would say, however, that you need to distinguish between licensing, and then we also have a whole series of other, whether it's board certification, and whether it's, as Ms. Brenner was saying, credentialing and other privileges to get into not only hospital privileges, but health plan privileges and others. Licensing right now is, once you pass your initial exams, then it is basically based on the number of education hours you do in specific areas. But almost every physician in the state right now, in addition to your license, is also board certified. Matter of fact, it's becoming a requirement by many health plans and others to be board certified. Board certification has an additional step that does try to assess, I think, what you're getting at. How do you practice? It assesses not only through a series of tests and exams you have to do, but there's also practical practice exams that you can try to perform periodically. So I think the profession is trying to address some of the concerns you're raising. I'm not certain if we're here. I know we're not here right now to say we should throw out how we license and start over, but we are trying to address through other credentialing activities. And Mr. Chair, just if I could also just go through some of the comments that we've had. Hopefully, I think all of you know that the Medical Association has spent most of last year looking at the whole issue of health reform and acknowledged that these are not simple answers, they're not simple issues to deal with. They are very interconnected and complex. Many people would look at Minnesota and say, why do we need to look at reform? We have the lowest uninsured in the nation. We are consistently voted the healthiest state in the nation. But our membership looked at this and said, no, we are in need of real reforms. When you look at the annual cost of health care in Minnesota is now about $11,000 per household, which is projected to double by 2010. When you look at the reductions that we're seeing right now, the increases in our uninsured numbers, concerns about access to quality, and then also when you look at how we compare to other countries cost-wise, it is a real concern. So I'm hoping you've all had a chance to look at our physician plan for a health plan, for Healthy Minnesota, that we did present to this meeting earlier. And I will say that many of the pieces that are Representative Abler's proposal are consistent with our recommendation. In his proposal, it's definitely a focus on prevention, treating chronic disease. That's where the money is spent. That's where I think we need to really focus and try to reduce those costs. President Abler's bill does have some health improvement grant funds in Article 2. Also, a focus on health promotion, wellness, related to obesity, smoking, nutrition, and other causes of preventable disease. And then another key piece that's in the bill that is consistent with our recommendations is what you were talking about, the congruent, and that is empowering consumers to be smarter purchasers of health care. There are a number of disclosure pieces in this bill which we think are consistent with our recommendations. We talked about the disclosure of administrative efficiency by health plans, disclosure of coverage options, the department's website, which we tried to beef up and put some additional information in there. But there's also measures in discussion about performance of healthcare providers. And that is something that we have been very actively working through the Community Measurement Project and others to promote, that we think there should be disclosure of performance among health providers. And we want to make sure that is valid information, that is helpful information, that it is scientifically appropriate. You also have information about cost, disclosure of cost information for consumers. Matter of fact, I point out, it's in the two somewhat conflicting sections in the bill. In Article 2, Section 3, I believe it is now, you talk about disclosing of average payments, charges and payments to hospitals and other healthcare providers for the top 20 procedures. And then, my understanding is, I read it, the Department of Health will designate what those top 20 procedures are. It potentially will exempt some providers if it becomes burdensome. But then later in Article 3, Section 3, you also then have language which talks about the Commissioner of Health should work with other stakeholder groups and others to develop what you call useful, reliable, and valid information to support purchasing health care based on value. We would suggest and encourage you to look at the second proposal, the Article 3 proposal. I think while we're not opposed to cost reporting, we think it needs to be helpful to consumers. And we think it needs to be valid and based on something that will be helpful, not just putting out more information. I'm not certain what we have in Article 2 will do so, but we think working with all the groups and trying to get some kind of system, I think, is a better way to go. And finally, I'd also just mentioned that you have, again, a strong focus on improving and promoting quality. We talked about the MSAFE guidelines that we are strongly supportive of, and also the potential financial rewards and others for payment mechanisms to promote and reward quality improvement. There are a couple pieces, there are two key pieces missing from the proposal, which we would suggest if you're looking at reforms, you should look at. One is insurance reforms. As you know, our report calls for a mandate that everybody have some form of coverage. We also call for some significant insurance reforms that talk about community rating and guarantee issues. Those issues cannot be separate. You need to have them connected, and we think that's an important need to broaden the risk pool and get more people covered. So that's something we think that is missing. Our proposal also talked a lot about the development, our process to develop the essential benefit set. We think that, again, a benefit set that's based on what's effective, what's good quality. We think that we at least need to have a process to start that discussion to get input from the different community rates. Let me, if I could also, Mr. Chair, comment on the three items that are in the bill, which we would even suggest may be detrimental to reform. One is in Article 2, Section 6, we have again the health-related licensing board involved to try to determine whether bills are excessive. First of all, this is not a role of any of the licensing boards have done. Matter of fact, some will argue it's a potential antitrust violation if you have a licensing board determining what's appropriate billing or not appropriate billing. And this is something that we would suggest that did not be included in the bill. Article 2, Section 16, you also then have some reporting dealing with malpractice outcomes. Again, I would argue this is unnecessary because current law requires that any malpractice case that results in payment, whether that be a verdict or whether that be a settlement, is required to be reported to the licensing boards. The licensing boards do investigate all of those cases, at least the Board of Medical Practice does. So the requirement is there to report to all the licensing boards. But I know the Board of Medical Practice at least investigates those cases. So they take further action, depends on case by case. So that action is not necessary.
Mr. Render, so they're informed. I was wondering about that earlier.
Yes.
So they're already informed already, so that's
good. Mr. Chair, yes. So, and I can get you the language. But the current law requires any time where there's a payment. Whether it be a settlement or a verdict.
And informed also about criminal conviction.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know if there is any requirement that the courts have to tell the boards about criminal investigations, but I can tell you that anytime there is a complaint made against a practitioner, at least against a physician, the board is required to investigate those cases. So even if it's just one patient calling up saying, I've got a complaint, the board is required to open a file and do an investigation in that case.
Thank you.
And I know also, Mr. Chairman, that there is an automatic permanent revocation for at least in the medical board for physicians if a physician is convicted of a sexual misconduct case. So, I mean, there are some situations where there is a report and an automatic suspension or revocation of license. And finally, Mr. Chair, Article 2, Section 18, this is where I think we were talking about the, a little earlier, again, the licensing board would be required to publicly disclose information about their licensees, and you included very well malpractice history. I would urge you to go slowly in that area. The concern that we have is that you will potentially be creating another disincentive for a practitioner to go into a high-risk specialty or potentially take on high-risk patients. There is currently under both state and federal law, there is requirements that, and again, settlements have to be reported nationally to the National Data Bank, the National Practitioner Data Bank. That information is not public, but it is available to licensing boards throughout the country. So if a physician has a malpractice history in Oklahoma and comes to Minnesota, that information is given to the Board of Medical Practice before issuing licensing.
Can you tell me, you've almost persuaded me on the malpractice part there, although it seems like it's something people would want to know, but I understand the other side of it. Is there, are those claims, if they go to trial, they're public. If there are settlements or not, is that probably true?
Mr. Chairman, in the actions of board medical practice?
No, the person who has a malpractice,
Then
he's sued and goes to trial and they do the whole trial, that would be a public record, I'm sure of that.
Mr.
But
Chair,
there would not be a record of the settlement if it was...
My understanding, Mr. Chairman, yes, is if there is a court verdict, if there goes to trial, that then becomes public information. If it's a settlement, it all depends on the settlement. Many settlements are not; they are closed. Not sometimes it's requested to be closed on the plaintiff's side, sometimes it's requested to be closed on the defendant's side, but that's usually negotiated there, part of the settlement.
And Mr. Chairman, people wouldn't mind, the board wouldn't mind having a listing of the licensees with various credentials and biographical data. That would not be a problem, do you think?
Mr. Chair, and members, I know the board of medical practice has been discussing profiling data of physicians for the last 2 years. They had a task force looking at this, made up of board members and also other practitioners, and they have been trying to come up with some profiling data that will be available on the board of medical practice website. My understanding is, as I said, in the meeting for a few years, malpractice issues have been part of those discussions. At this point, they have decided not to include malpractice history, but yes, they are trying to make it easier for consumers to find out about Dr. Smith. How long has Dr. Smith been practicing? Where did he or she go to medical school? The residents don't have the good money.
Thanks. That's going to help me.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Renner, you talked a little bit about the community measurement project and that you supported that, or the MMA supports that. Do you think it's possible to do that sort of thing on individual practitioners versus a clinic? I mean, just based on the number of people that treat.
Mr. Chair, and members, no. What the experts have told me, and I'm not a statistician or my quality or data expert, but everything I've heard and read from those who have is said that in order for the data to be valid, to have any meaning, it has to be a large enough base of patients to be able to make sure that it has meaning. Most, I think, would argue that it can get down to hospital level, potentially clinic or system level, but you need, I wish I could remember the exact number, but somebody was giving an example, I think, of those who treat breast cancer, and the number of patients that you need to have in the mix to ensure validity is in the multiple thousands. So I don't think it would work at the end of the level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Renner, do you have any ideas for making sure that patients have better access to fees and better disclosure of those fees and better information about possibly lower cost alternatives to suggested treatments. What are you folks doing about that?
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair, it is a difficult issue, and one of the reasons it's difficult is because we have a payment system in healthcare that is meaningless to most patients. The difficulty you run into when you start talking about charges, I mean, Representative Bradley had some language in one of his bills last year that was passed in the law, talking about disclosing your charges. Well, to most of us, charges is an irrelevant number because we are all, if you have any kind of health coverage, you have just a negotiated payment rate that gets paid back to the payer that is not based on those charges. And then it gets difficult with the fee that a physician gets for the same procedure from Blue Cross is significantly different than they get from Medicare or from health partners. Or then when you throw in how the fee they get from public payers like Medicaid or Medicare is significantly different. So that's the reason why we are struggling with how to do this. I think the language that is included in Article 3 talks about, directs the Commissioner of Health to bring some, to bring together stakeholder groups, bring together a group to sit down and say, how can we make this not only valid but meaningful for patients? I think if we, most physicians right now, most clinics will say that they would be happy. If you ask, they will tell you what their fees are. But as a patient, that doesn't mean anything to me because that's not what my payment out of pocket is.
Well,
that's a good one.
Mr. Chair, don't you think that part of the problem with healthcare is that people have no idea, they can't compare costs from one doctor to another, find out, which is true a lot of times, that a specialist is cheaper than a GP and for certain procedures. There's no way to do that kind of a cost comparison. If we get all different rates for different insurance companies, and then we have a separate rate for the private pay that where you may be trying to make up other costs, we've got a really skewed system, and the healthcare cost stuff shows that of all of the increases in healthcare, the one largest increase is in physicians. Is in what physicians have increased their rates or their fees or whatever in the past few years. So with that in mind, I would hope that your board would start to think about how you're going to make that information more available to people and help them be responsible for their own health care costs.
Mr. Bennett.
Mr. Chair, we don't disagree with you at all. I mean, I think that is the most confusing piece to our health care system right now. The trouble we're running into this is how do you disclose something that is meaningful to a patient? What we have argued initially, and if you look at our plan that we put forward, we think that cost disclosure is a key piece to it. We think it needs to be tied together with also quality, so what you're trying to purchase and disclose here is value. Not just who's cheapest, not just who's the best, but what's the best value. What we would argue is we think it's most important, and we think it's easier initially, is to start doing disclosure on the quality piece. And then we do need to do some additional work. But we agree with you that this is a piece that it is very difficult. If our goal is to make this much more transparent so that consumers can buy value, then we need to find a way to include cost in that data. We just don't think that by listing the top 20 codes that Department of Health says these are the top 20 codes, and list what your charges are, we don't think that necessarily helps consumers make a better choice.
That's a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I know that we have a law that supposedly prevents providers from charging more to private pay, but I also know that law is not followed. And I'm concerned about being able to hide the higher fees by not exposing those rates. And I really, I'm a really strong supporter of this piece because I think that until we do that, we're not going to be able to get a handle on healthcare costs. We're not going to be able to reduce healthcare costs. And so if that isn't the answer, and you don't have, the quality piece is fine, but that doesn't tell the consumer anything if they're on a limited budget and have to pay for their own health care, which is increasingly the issue in Minnesota. So that is not solving anything as far as the costs of the system go. So I really hope that you'll figure out a way to do that. In the meantime, I'd be satisfied with doing this until we can find a better way.
That's some help. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Goodwin, I agree with you. I think that if a facility charges different fees for clients under Health Partners, for instance, and clients under Blue Cross Blue Shield, then maybe the public should know that. And if they are charging private pay patients far and above those rates, then that ought to be disclosed as well. Those of us around this table in this room are aware that it's happening, but the consumers certainly do not. So I think that's something they need to be aware of. And that in and of itself could bring some market pressures on the industry.
Let me just clarify something just so people understand. I don't think anybody has a dual fee schedule. As I also understood, that's called fraud. But you set a price. And this price, except for a few carriers in this room, most people don't pay the retail price. Cash people pay the retail price. And some plans do, and some plans have negotiated discounts because of the wonderful value of being part of that network. That's what they tell us anyway. So we get to have all the business they bring in the relationship, which Christmas cards and all they send along. But anyway, if you charge $100 for some procedure, that's your price. Blue Cross might reimburse $65, Medical might reimburse $67, because they're way better. Anyway, but they have a price anyway, so it may even depend on the plan you're in under those particular sets, and it's not even the same provider. There's each one is 100 different products, and medical assistance pays about $40. But the price charge is the same. And if a person paying cash walks in the door and winds up paying $100, which is one of the things I tried to resolve. Are you done? Do you want to talk anymore?
No, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your clarification. That was the point I was going to make as well. And I would just add that one of the main reasons why we've gotten into this problem is because of our whole cost-shifting issue with the public programs. The public programs are the worst payers.
Yeah.
And again, so what's ended up happening is you end up shifting those elsewhere. The bad fact is right now, the person that ends up paying the full retail is usually the uninsured, and that's something we think needs to be addressed as well. But it's not that we are charging more, it's that we get paid at a discount rate for some payers versus others.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to come up, Scott and Bob, on it and talk about this? Oh, sorry. We just don't have any. I don't want to speak. He didn't wiggle away yet. That's not helping.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Renner, have you done any work on these? You talk about these essential benefits that, which actually was at another meeting this morning where we discussed a similar thing. And I mean, the example would be certain plastic surgeries. If you want to look like a movie star, I guess that's your business, but why do I have to pay for it? Or LASIK surgery on your eyes is debatable, whether it does you any better than glasses. But has the MMA done really anything to look at what they consider an essential benefit? So,
Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, yes and no. Over the last, my 16 years of medical association, we've had two separate task forces trying to look at what we refer to then as basic benefits maps. And it is a very difficult thing to do. We went through a significant process in both those situations and came up with what we thought was a basic benefit set. Tried to promote it, didn't get a lot of support, even sometimes among our own membership, because of course what one person defines as essential, another says it's not, and that's the debate. What we're trying to do in our report, when our task force looked at this, we did not go into that kind of detail, mainly because we said we don't think we as physicians can do it on our own. We think this needs to have the public involvement as well. This does get into some issues of is it essential or is it just nice to have, and how much should we pay? I mean, an example that was in our report that we've used significantly is ultrasound in pregnancies. There is no study that shows in a normal pregnancy that there is any advantage, any improvement in outcome for either mother or the child for use of an ultrasound. But it becomes standard care to get, if not one, multiple ultrasounds. Now, is that because the practitioner wants to make sure and use it for defensive medicines, or is it because the parents like to get an early picture of the baby? So it's that's an example of something. But to answer your question directly, we have not put any more detail on that right now. We think the parents are involved in that discussion.
Thank you. I think you can escape if you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Johnson. Do you have your own thoughts, or do you want to talk about dual billing and fraud?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Just a couple of... I have two caps today, Mr. Chairman. I wear the cap representing auto insurers, who write virtually all of the auto insurance in the state. I also have a cap representing commercial health insurers who write virtually no coverages. So maybe it's the latter one that's most relevant, but it is relevant. And it's changed since when I started lobbying, which goes back to when a number of people in this room before they were born now. But and history is helpful sometimes to look at it. But if I can, Mr. Chairman, I don't know the appetite here and whether you want to make this a debate or discussion or hearing on no-fault auto.
I was thinking maybe not.
I can put on my little cap and I can be very
careful. Hold on if you would.
I can't. Well, that's
good. You can offer a comment, please offer your thought.
Can I say just a couple of things? Yeah. We did deliver, Mr. Chairman, to your office 50 copies of a blue booklet that committee members want to see. The conclusions of the state's auto insurers on the performance of our Chapter 65B, which is our no-fault auto law, and how is it working today? That booklet will give you the conclusion of companies that write virtually all of the auto insurance in the state, and we formed it early. No, I don't have it here.
The members can watch for those from the deal that we can.
But I do urge members at some point. We will have a debate on no-fault auto, and we'll have an extensive debate on it because we need it. But let me just tell you three comments about our conclusions and on auto insurance. Is that the number of uninsured drivers is at an all-time high, and it's going higher. So one out of six drivers is driving today in Minnesota without auto insurance, and that's a crime. And we're at an all-time high. From our perspective in the auto insurance system, consumers are today they're paying for two systems, not one, two systems. The traditional personal responsibility plus the no-fault auto. And third, fraud in the no-fault auto system is out of control. That's our conclusion. It is out of control today. And that is directly relevant, Mr. Chairman, with some language that you have in the draft bill. Maybe with that, Mr. Chairman, I can segue into that, and
sure.
I'd be happy to front, but I don't think you want to get into that.
Yeah, I'll give your comments to the
bill. There's a lot of people in the room that might want to get into that too. Then you'd have to schedule more time.
Just not today. So
not today. But I would like to, if I can, Mr. Chairman, just on focus on your comments on intent behind your process in the draft, and that's important. Your intent on creating a marketplace where there isn't a market. I agree with that. And trying to bring back players who have left. I don't know how broad that reference was, but I agree with that.
I'll let you guys say.
And so, there are some key developments that have happened that haven't been good for buyers in this state, and I think that's one of them, and I can comment on that. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I think the marketplace, in Minnesota, one of the things I wanted to urge on the commercial marketplace, why is it today in Minnesota that when you leave the top three companies, the fourth place commercial health insurer, I think that's the exact number today, but somebody has it probably over at MCHA, you immediately hit companies that are less than 1% of the market. So the collapse and the consolidation of the competitive marketplace as we used to have it has been so significant. And part of the reason small buyers, small employers, are saying, crying out, do something to help us, is because the choices are diminished. It's the fact of the matter. We have a collapsed, consolidated market. Companies that used to be a significant number of companies writing commercial health insurance, selling, competing, and they're gone. Prudential, ING, ReliaStar, MSI, Lutheran Brotherhood. There was a long list of Minnesota companies that were active players in the Minnesota marketplace. And I go through that not just because marketplaces change. Some companies cut it, some don't. That happens. That isn't the issue. Other things that have happened that have specifically driven down the number of competitors. And once a state, this state, loses the competitive marketplace, and we have the small employers. Bringing it back is a tall order. And I've been open and direct with anybody that's asked me about that. It's a tall order. It's hard. When companies leave, there's a good chance they're not going to come back, and that's just the truth of the matter. So I think the challenge, Mr. Chairman, on at least to that extent of trying to bring back players who have left, it's hard. It's worthy of study. I think one of the issues that, and I'll just state it, I've stated to some members, because then it maybe is, it's an even thornier issue, because frankly, in the consolidated marketplace that we have today, one of the realities is the following, and Mr. Chairman, you were commenting, committee members were talking about, who pays the retail, and then the variations on what negotiated rates are. Well, those negotiated discounts are limited in who all can obtain them. Now, once you leave places 1, 2, and 3 in the marketplace, there aren't any left. That's really the truth of the matter. And so the ability of companies other than the top three to compete when the disadvantage of that negotiated reimbursement is so enormous, and that's just the reality of the marketplace. How do you deal with it? I don't have a solution to that. I just flag it, Mr. Chairman, because in terms of you asked me, the little slice that I mentioned, what is probably the most pivotal issue, that's the most pivotal issue. That's the fact of the matter. So we have a healthy, for instance, and I haven't commented on it, we have a healthy reinsurance marketplace for health insurance. We don't have a healthy primary marketplace for health insurance. And so there's plenty of reinsurers selling the product, and frankly, they're out there because they're selling the self-insured plan. So as the marketplace just continues, we see it up here every year. Bills this year, companies looking to get out of the regulated marketplace. Of course that's happening. It continues to happen. Pools, both that's ways to do it. Whether it's Chapter 62H or what have you, we all continue to see that growth of the evaporation of the regulated marketplace. So I think there's some areas worthy of study, Mr. Chairman, and I think that from the industry's perspective, our diminished role, we truly are at a point in a position where trying to kickstart that for the small employers of the state is difficult. It's going to be hard. I don't know, if we continue to look at alternatives to the insurance marketplace, pools, groups, arrangements, frankly, that are looking to get out from the state law and state-imposed costs. But, of course, then all that does, at the end of it, also jeopardizes the state programs. We all know that's the case. The MCHA assessment base and how it's operating, it's not sustainable. It's not workable. It's not fair. It's not right. It's not the way to operate. It needs to be fixed. It used to be a general revenue supported function. It's not today. I don't know if we can get back to it because of the budget realities. But I think those forces that are continuing to squeeze that diminished segment of the market, we have to start taking some steps to get out from under that. But if I can, Mr. Chairman, I would urge, and I want to comment because you had up front made in some of the intent language, I'll just for a second go back to no fault auto. I agree with you. I mean, you commented on the need to get at fraud and said it's an important issue. It is an important issue. So I just wanted to urge you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think the language in here, I don't want to focus on that because you don't want me to. About tying and licensing.
I didn't want to do a Norfolk debate. You can comment on that.
Well, I can comment on that.
Yeah, please.
There are four sections.
If you can keep it in language now because the overall...
I think there's language in the bill.
It would take up a better part of the summer to get that one.
It would. Mr. Chairman, I would comment that I don't believe that the Article 2, whatever, if it's Section 2 now in the introduced bill, I would disagree. I don't think you want to tie up the Commerce Department now hired a chief law enforcement officer. It is a full criminal investigatory agency with full board certified law enforcement on it. Their efforts to work on fraud should not be tied up by an okay from a licensing board. Licensing board is not a criminal investigative agency.
Can I have a post-board licensing?
Well, it's a police department, post-board. Oh. In other words, law enforcement officers get post-board certified. These are people that are entrusted under state law to do the kind of criminal investigation work, including, in this case, insurance fraud. It's just not appropriate, in my opinion, to tie up the activities of a law enforcement agency to get an okay from a licensing board on criminal fraud investigations. I don't believe it's done anywhere else, and I don't think it should be done in an no-fault auto area.
Let me ask you a question, just so you can get my intent better. We argue, well, in court, your colleagues and mine sit there and haggle about billing and what codes to be used for what, and there's different levels of service. Would it ever rise to the occasion of fraud where somebody erroneously or even habitually used the wrong code? That's what I was trying to get at. There would not be some spurious thing. They'd say, well, no, don't waste time. That's nothing, you know. We're training the board to say, we obviously need to educate better. These people are using the wrong code consistently. You know, it's our fault we didn't help them more. We're going to, but that's not, go after somebody who's really fraudulent. Is this an issue at all, or am I just...
Mr. Chairman, my reaction to it, as you described it, is that, no, I don't believe you'd see. In other words, criminal intent standards is not going to be present if somebody is mistakenly coding, or if they're repeating some of those mistakes. Until you cross over into the criminal intent box, and only when you cross in, that is when that kicks in. At least
that was my thinking, just
as you describe it. That doesn't, to me, indicate the kind of activity that would cross into the activity.
You would say, now we're going to help you get this guy out.
Yeah, and I think that kind of activity seems to me to be more within the purview of the licensing board, and there's kind of mistakes of practice and mistakes in how they're operating. And that's what it is. That doesn't strike me as the criminal intent standards. It has to be triggered to get into insurance.
So, in lateness, perhaps, at this point in the current law, how much. Let's say you find a guy who's billing for visits he didn't do. That's a pretty good example of fraud.
Yeah.
Or a woman that billed. And so now you're on the case. At what point do you engage the licensing board and let them know that they're being investigated and even get their help? Or do you tell them at the end, or when it comes out in the paper? Or
well, Mr. Chairman, you know what I think would be best? I don't want to... I think it'd be best to follow up with you and have someone either from a fraud unit. We've had a fraud unit for 10 years at the Commerce Department of Labor and Industry. I think who could describe exactly the procedure. I don't have that here today, but that's one section. The other one, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Renner commented on it, and I appreciate your intent, and I do, on the excessive claims, but I think the language in the Article 2 dealing with excessive claims, again, unless the standards are specific, enumerated in the law as to what is excessive, but I don't think it's generic. You can challenge it as just excessive, and then the board determines what excessive is not going to be a workable. And I appreciate that, and I do. The notion behind that, we certainly don't disagree with that notion. But the law is going to have to be, however we get at that, and that's where we get into the debate on no fault. Do you write into the law treatment standards or parameters that are medically developed that represents the kind of the best thinking of the profession on what is the type of practice or the type of treatment for specific types of injuries? I think the law, and the debate we'll have to have, needs to get specific to Chapter 65B and all the various groups involved. And then when that's written in the law, now we've got the basis to do the kinds of challenging if somebody is operating outside of that. Otherwise, I don't think Mr. Chairman is going to prove to be a workable framework to get at that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
and what was the section? Was that Mr. Johnson?
Well, it's Article 2. Well, I've got it, Section 8. It's a 65B.665 paragraph on excessive claims, specifically under the no-fault auto. But again, it's
Section 5, I think.
I don't have the introduced bill, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, there's copies.
Oh, I didn't grab it.
Anyway, so is the whole file there, or they have not? We can get you more.
That's the second one. The third one,
oh, that's not it.
Yeah,
oh,
that
six. A little different than it was earlier.
Oh. I'm going to ask for the original bill.
Go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Then the... I think the immediately related to that same comment in the Article 2, the health-related board, at least what I have, is no-fault auto injuries and the practice standards issue. I think similarly, there's a whole debate that started and will go forward at some point here, and we've chatted periodically about that, about the need to specifically establish. Again, I think who does it? If it's done, if you look at the 10 no-fault states in America today, and those that have acted, they have acted specifically and written into the law, fee schedule, treatment standards, practices. In other words, it's specifically enumerated what the coverage is, so everybody knows what it does. And I think, that'll be part of the debate and the discussion, and when we get to that, then I think it needs to be part of Chapter 65B. Assuming we keep no-fault auto, and I think there'll be a debate on that, about the future of that. But then, lastly, and it's probably appropriate, Mr. Chairman, in Article 3, there is a study on no-fault medical costs. miscellaneous studies. If it's the second section under Article 3 still. Yeah, it is the second section under Article 3. That, again, I think if there's going to be a study of no fault, it needs to be a broad-based study. This, if you haven't changed it from the draft that I have, is it the same? It's too prescriptive and narrow in what study. In other words, the notion of there being medical outliers, but then only study the outliers, that's how I read the language, is that it limits, defines who the outliers are and thus limits the study. There's going to be a study of no fault. It needs to be a study of all no fault.
Would you rewrite what you would say if you were going to have some influence, which you might just find out yourself having?
I don't fear studies and looking at the system. In fact, welcome looking at the system.
Well, also decide who you suggest should conduct it and how would it be best done from your point of view. I want it to be practical. Just to understand, this was all meant to be kind of a narrowly focused thing.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, those are the comments I had on those four specific sections, and would be happy to
answer. Let me ask one more question of you, and then we'll take questions from the members here. Back to the question about billing.
Yes.
How do you feel? Can you comment on if a person had a cash guy walked up to some door and said, "I'm cash, give me a discount"? How do you feel about that? Now, where are you referring that? As opposed to being a member of the group, like you join Medi-Cal, you join some buying club or something, and then you get a discount because they join the club. As opposed to just do you think people are currently allowed to offer people a discount because they walk up and they say, "I'd like a discount because I'm a cat"? And just because I want a discount and that as an individual, is that legal?
Mr. Chair, I'm gonna pass on giving you an opinion. I have an opinion on if it's legal or not. I have to tell you, Mr. Chair, my focus, this is kind of where I live, is trying to figure out a way to kickstart the competitive market issue.
Yeah.
I'm a bias of it. No, I live there, I believe in half.
You can dodge questions.
But, yeah, that's my answer. I will, because I actually don't know how to add anything constructively.
Okay, right.
I try to avoid things that I can't add anything constructively. But we think it is worth this, as you look at it, any study of marketplace. Competitive marketplaces are actually good for consumers. I think the literature is clear. I think to the extent when you have them, there's a beneficial impact of the companies fighting for business, and we think buyers win in that. When you lose them, then I think you find evidence that the buyers also lose some of the benefits of competitive marketplaces. I think for us as a state, we've clearly gone down a route. We've clearly seen dramatic consolidation and collapse of what's available. And it's affected, it continues to affect the marketplace.
Let me just say a good question for you. Who else that's here today wants to talk today, I think? Two people, three, either stretch four people. It's like an altar call, I see it. So members, I think we'll do some more of this tomorrow, too, so a lot of you will be back tomorrow. If you can't be back tomorrow, are you back tomorrow? We'll make sure we get a hold of you. So you'll be next. So we're going to take testimony today and tomorrow. We might have some amendments tomorrow. We might meet again Thursday. But what I'm trying to do is what this exactly is about. So if you have a concern about a part, tell us your concern. Tell us that you thought about the intent. And members, bring in mind the time. That's a good when you're up. And just you can keep your questions kind of short.
Thank you. I just need clarification, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson. I remember when no-fault insurance started in the 70s, I believe, wasn't it? And I remember the insurance industry fighting hard to get no-fault insurance because they believed that it would be cheaper for them and less lawsuits and so forth. And I pretty much think that the insurance industry got exactly what they asked them for on that. But if I'm wrong, let me know, because that's my recollection.
Short answer to that?
No, short answer, Mr. Chairman. I urge you, bring Senator Jack Davies here, who is the chief author of No Fault Auto. He's in these buildings almost every day, and ask him whether the insurance industry sought, asked for, or worked for No Fault Auto. I'll tell you the answer. The answer is no. About a third of the industry was supported, two-thirds was not. It was not passed in Minnesota at the initiation of the auto insurers of the state.
Okay.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked a little bit earlier about how we have a vibrant reinsurance market, and I think you made that with regard to a lot of the big self-insured plans. And we had testimony here earlier that there are some of these smaller pools and others who are actually having trouble getting into that finding affordable reinsurance. I just wanted to see if there was more nuance than what your statement stated.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think a little more nuance. I'll stand by it because it's true. It is a healthy, competitive private reinsurance market. But remember, again, reinsurance is traditionally and for the most part. That's the insurance company's insurance company. And the kind of the dollars, the level of attachment, where they sell pragmatically is not at those small groups and pools. What's happened in the marketplace with the, you know, the continued peeling away from the regulated marketplace, and Ms. Bruner commented on it, the pools aren't maybe not what they're necessarily cut out to be, and small pool arrangements are probably unstable, and reinsurers don't have to sell insurance to them, and probably are not going to. So I think comments from somebody who's trying to kickstart one of those small ones, there's a very good chance they're not going to get any bids, not because there aren't plenty of sellers, but nobody is interested in working with that pool.
Just simple.
Oh, I had one other question, and I don't know if this is... I just wanted to see if you had any reactions, and maybe this is not even your area, but, you know, we've had, and there's some reference in here, but the whole malpractice issue and why the rates on malpractice for doctors are going up so much. I just wondered if you had any particular comments you'd like to make with regard to that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've been publicly, we're strong supporters of medical liability reform, and that we believe that, and I, at the risk of opening that, but we publicly and continue to believe a medical liability reform is necessary and should be a part of the healthcare cost containment equation. And claims and, you know, the claim payment and what's happened in that marketplace, while Minnesota is clearly not a crisis state in medical liability, we're not. It's a pivotal piece of fixing the liability in the system, securing it, defining it in a way that'll help the private marketplace. So I don't know if that's responsive. I mean, we believe that there needs to be medical liability reform. We believe it needs to be part of the equation. And there have been debates on that for nursing homes this year, or ER, you know, the emergency ambulance firms, and other issues, and other disciplines, physicians, emergency room physicians, and the reason they're coming to the table is because of the state of the marketplace.
I think that's the best non-answer you're going to get.
Well, okay, I think
they're part of it. Well, that's the medical liability reform, and they're not in the bill, so I think it should be.
Well, there is
that's
one piece in the bill. There is one piece in the bill, actually. And the I guess my question is, one of the things that we've been hearing a lot about is the problem is that we don't have this competitive marketplace, that so many people are leaving that market, and whether you have any ideas about how I'm not convinced that putting caps on things are going to actually bring people back to the marketplace, and so whether you have any other specific ideas about how you would reinvigorate that competitive marketplace.
Maybe the short answer on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we could chat another time. The short answer
is having
watched a lot of marketplaces over a lot of years, companies leave marketplaces not because they want it. They leave marketplaces they can't make any money.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens. And so everybody's left for it. Many of the players have left that marketplace. That tells me is that there's instability in the prediction, you know, the claims, the what's going out. And if companies can't accurately predict it, claims, they're likely to not write. How do you produce predictability in claims? Define the law so you know the liabilities in it. We know the liabilities, and I suggest that would improve the competitive marketplace.
Okay, we got to move on from that point. So maybe there's more to come with Mr. Erickson from the question.
I'll try to make it short, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, going back to your concerns on Article 2, Section 2, on the investigations by the health-related boards, you're saying that the Commerce Department is already performing that function? Is that odd unit that was brought over there either last year or the year before from DPS?
Mr. Chairman, the quick sequencing is that 3 years ago, a new fraud unit was created in the Commerce Department. Once it was created, then a year ago, the fraud unit from the Department of Labor and Industry was moved into it. And the auto theft prevention program from the Department of Public Safety was officially moved into it. So now there's one insurance fraud unit under the direction of Commissioner Wilson.
That's all I need. Thank you.
of some Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, this is kind of a philosophical question. We've got the big three, and then we've got the smaller indemnity companies that you represent. And a lot of economists will say that most markets tend towards oligopolies or monopolies anyway, unless somebody else does something to shake that up. And you said that your companies can't compete because they can't negotiate discounts. So is there any hope that any of your companies are going to come back in and become dominant? And I might point out that there's one company, Ucare, that's done remarkably well in increasing their market share, even though they're a little player.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, I think, just briefly, I mean, I've been pessimistic about the future and bringing back companies that used to write that don't write here. You know, a company principal, giant company down in Des Moines, they dropped their premium writings in Minnesota 75% in the last 3 years. They're a major small group company around the country, and they're not writing here. They've dramatically cut that. So there are a lot of factors that are affected. This isn't a sympathy thing. That's just the reality. And so Minnesota is unique. Other states, there is a lot of collapsing or consolidation. But I have to tell you, Mr. Huntley, there are, you look at a lot of the other marketplaces in Minnesota, pick one, work comp, life insurance, liability, auto insurance. They do not tend to consolidate. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The competition has grown. The markets are diverse. They're not owned by large companies, but there are all kinds of small, healthy, niche players in most of those other lines of insurance. So I suggest that health is uniquely different in the state from virtually any other line of insurance that personal and commercial buyers encounter, which fortunately is a healthy, competitive marketplace.
I couldn't. Okay. Thank you. You guys did pretty well. It was nice to have you come up. And sir, would you like to come up, please?
Yeah.
Hello, welcome. Introduce yourself and tell us on your mind.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Monsignor Roman. That's a strange first name. It's my great grandfather who died in Minnesota. I grew up in California. And I apologize. I don't represent anybody but myself.
Even better.
And what I'd like to do, and I'm nervous, I'm humbled, I'm a bit embarrassed to be here, and a bit shaky, but what I'd like to do is sort of describe to you, first of all, my situation personally, and I've brought documentation if somebody wants to look at it. I right now live in a Rural 36 facility at 131 Oak Grove Street. I'm on RSDI or SSDI. I have a fairly high payment from them because I worked in professional category for most of my life until I was diagnosed with mental illness and physical illnesses in 1990. I receive about $1,200 a month Social Security disability. Most of my friends make less than that, much less than that. In order to pay my fee at the Rural 36 facility, I have to pay $700 a month. My spend down, in order to qualify for MA, is over $600 per month. Add it together. I don't get $76 back. I don't get a cent back. And that's before I get one day at a hospital or one med paid to me. I have proof of this here. I can show it to you. I'm on 20 medications. I'm not contagious or anything. I have various mental illnesses and various heart diseases and so on and so forth. I take 20 different medications per day. The bill for that came yesterday, or last week, $1,645. Now that's the basis I'm working from by coming here today. I don't qualify for MA because I can't pay that amount. If I don't take my meds, and I have serious mental illnesses at times, I've attempted suicide. If I become homeless again, because the Rule 36 is closing in June, I can almost guarantee you where I'll be. I'll either be dead or back in Anoka, which is much more expensive for you and for me, and I don't, you know, because I'm trying to live. I have six children, all of which, fortunately, they don't have my mental illnesses like that. I have generally gone to HCMC. I'm told that major amounts of money are being taken away from them. I also had ECTs, electroconvulsive therapy. HCMC quit doing those. They referred me outpatient. They referred me to Abbott. Abbott Northwestern charges $50 per treatment. I was getting four a month. I don't have $200. They cut it down to two a month. I don't have $100. My HCMC has been very good to me over the years. In fact, they've saved my life. However, if I go to my psychiatrist, who's not a member of HCMC, he writes a prescription for my four or five medications. I cannot go to HCMC to have them filled at a lower cost, because HCMC has negotiated discounts and they are under some kind of restriction that they can only take prescriptions from HCMC doctors. That's buff on me, needless to say. At the Rule 36, I have no choice of pharmacies. They order my meds. They get them. I get the bill. So I can't even go to HCMC. I can't even go to Butler Drug or wherever. To be honest, I read the bill. I saw the newspaper that said that you're having these. I looked up the little green book and looked up people's names. But to try, for example, for me to get into MinCare, I have to show that 3 months I've had no coverage, no insurance coverage. Who's going to pay just for my meds for those 3 months, which would be over, my math is correct, $4,500. Near as well, the consistent doctor's appointments I have to go to. And I'm going to tell them, I can't pay you guys. Of course, this isn't going to affect my credit rating at all. But at the end of 3 months, I may qualify for MinCare, and they're going to pay you back. I've been told that. I don't even know if that's true. But there's no way of going to my various medical people and saying that kind of thing. In addition to what's going on, which is not in your area, the changes they're making in the bankruptcy law, as I acquire these medical debts, I won't be able to declare bankruptcy and get rid of them. Not that I want to do that. I don't want to do that. But I'm under the system you're presently under. I don't know what these people are really telling you about competition and this and that and the other. All I know, nobody's knocking on my door to cover me. And when I try to go to alternatives, they say, well, we're going to exclude your pre-existing conditions, Mr. Rowley. Where does that put me? So I'm here, I don't even know why I'm here, except to say I'm in a very frustrated, vulnerable, embarrassing position. And I love this state. I do. I came from out west, and one of the reasons I settled here was because of the quality of life here. I raised my children here. I don't know what you can do. I testified several weeks ago at the Senate Health and Human Services Committee as well. And since then, I've got all this other stuff that came in. I'm frustrated. I'm sorry to have taken up your time, but I thought maybe you'd like to see somebody that's trying his hardest to make the system work, and it doesn't.
It's good you came. Well, we might want to ask you a question. Does anybody want to ask Mr. Rowley a question? Oh, it's good you came. Actually, it's good you came. It's good to hear it from people.
Yeah. Chair, Mr. Rowley, could you go through your fine? You're on SSDI.
Yes.
So they give you, you said?
I get $1,231, and they subtract $500 a year for premiums for Medicare. I do qualify for Medicare. I do, HCMC does take Medicare. It's for a certain amount of, it gets me beyond belief. But a whole bunch of it they don't. But now that they're because of HCMC, some of those programs I used to get, I no longer qualify for.
And do you pay for your Rule 36 facility?
Yes, sir.
How much do you pay there?
$700 a month.
So that leaves you with zero.
Exactly. It's $500 a year.
That's $500 a year, but it's over $500 spend down, which leaves me zero.
I understand that. Yeah.
And so how do I, I'm supposed to have a phone, I'm supposed to take my meds, I have to take the bus to get here. I mean, just simple things, very simple things. I live a very simple life. I don't go out to eat, I don't go to coffee shops, unless I can drink water.
What's the pizza? I don't want to go to a coffee shop.
You know, thank you for coming here, because it does, individual cases like yours. Some of you have had a successful life and then run into some health issues. Makes a big impact on us.
And
the committee ought to think about HCMC, which lost $30 million last year and will lose an additional $17 million if we pass the governor's bill.
It's drastic for a person like me because that is a very good facility. It's been very kind. It has saved my life literally more than once. Your decision.
Well, it's good you came today, and it's you've made an impact. So thank you, Mr. Rowley. Yeah, and come again sometime. Who else wanted to talk today? Mr. Carlson, can you come back tomorrow? Do you want to do it now? Anybody who can't come back, Mr. John Gross, do you want to do it? Or somebody else is going to want to talk to? Who else is there in the hand?
Over here.
Yes. Okay. Any mind? Well, who wants to? What's the thing you want to go? I guess we got a volunteer.
We'll get you all done today. Who knows?
Hi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Beth Hartwig. I represent Minnesota Business Partnership. I appreciate that work that you've put into your bill, and it's a good discussion, I think, that we're hearing today and have heard over the last couple of months. I'm just going to comment on a couple pieces of the bill, some of which people have already spoken to, and others. Article 1, Section 5, the voluntary purchasing pool, I would echo the concerns that have been spoken about voluntary pools and how they function in the long term. Not necessarily a bad idea, it's just how do we make, you know, how can we make those work. Article 2, Section 4, evidence-based medicine, the guidelines. Again, I would echo what you've heard on that. I think evidence-based the partnership supports that premise. How we get there exactly, what's in here might need some tweaking, but I think using standards that are being worked on by groups like ICSI and so forth are a good thing, and this is a positive step forward. Same article, section 7 on agency websites. I think getting the more information we can get out to consumers and the more ways possible is good. We need to be mindful of how we're using state dollars to do that. But if we can do it in an efficient manner and get more information out there, I think that's an excellent step. The last piece that I wanted to speak to specifically was the in Article 3, your miscellaneous section on cost information, how we get cost information connected with quality in order to get value. And that's really the key to the partnership vision on healthcare is value in healthcare. And you have to have both cost and quality to get there. We think in order for healthcare to be a market, which it isn't today, you need to engage the consumer, and that's important information. There are efforts, we're trying to bring together plans, providers, and other groups to figure out how we get to that cost information. So there are efforts in the private sector at connecting cost with quality in order to get value. So I know it's hard to say, you know, wait to see what might happen in the private sector in the next year, but that might be an area that you could wait and see what we're able to come up with in the next year. So, but that those are the specific sections that I wanted to speak to today. Happy to answer.
Thanks. No questions, members? Thank you. Thank you, Paula. Good job. You want to come up?
Your client testimony is almost identical, so you want to come to the... Oh, it might be a little different, huh? A little different, maybe. Okay. I like this, the government twin testimony here.
I just kind of want to ask what bill does this thing. On that purchasing pool, and I'm open to your comments, that bill passed like without any comments through the, that's the Knobloch bill. Maybe it's just different who the author is, but. That was a Knobloch purchasing bill. So if you have concerns about that, it's on the floor. So just to let you know.
Mr. Carlson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I have a legal research and government affairs business in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. Just briefly comment on a couple provisions in the bill. Starting, Mr. Chairman and members, with Article 2, Section 8 on the cancer drug repository. I know we're making headway.
Good short version then.
We're making headway on that language, Mr. Chairman, but it's not quite there yet, and we just want to make certain that an appropriate protection is given for the donor of the drugs and encourage them to do it.
To that point, there's some language in the engrossment on the bill. I'm not sure what engrossment this language is. This is old language, I think.
I would describe this as what passed out of civil law.
Yeah, it's been tweaked up since then. Okay. So there's a tweak in that. So please look at that and give us advice.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we'll continue to
sure. That was in here, so you brought it up.
I have some concerns about it. I didn't want you to think that since it's in there and I didn't say anything about it, that we were comfortable with
that's the language. Fine,
yeah. A much bigger concern is on page 27 of the draft, which is Article 2, Section 11. And this is a bill, I believe, of President Powell's House File 651, I believe. This places a hard cap of $300,000 on any claim arising out of care from a non-governmental EMT. And this is probably the most significant cost shift in your bill. This is not a cap on non-economic damages. This is a hard cap of $300,000. We are aware of cases, although they are extremely rare, thankfully, where the damages far exceed $300,000. And this provision would shift those costs from the responsible party to either the family or onto the taxpayers. And I would point out that what happens when you have a liability cap like this for one entity that may be in the that may be responsible for an injury, what you do is you take the other defendants and they focus on any culpability from the party with the cap or limited liability, and they all point the finger at them. And so what you're going to have here is for those EMTs that are non-governmental agencies, which we are now treating as the government, should there be a claim that would be, you know, our advice on one bill was not heard in the civil law committee. One of the things we would testify to there is that you're going to have these particular entities become the target defendant. So that there's an ability to try and put as much of the blame on to this entity with their limited liability. We have some serious reservations about that provision. I would also tell you that I have not seen any way, shape, or form of this where this would reduce any cost or save any money for the company involved. Minnesota has the lowest medical malpractice premiums in the country. It is less than 0.5% of our total healthcare spending. We had only 140 cases of medical malpractice filed in Minnesota last year. And in 2003, according to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, Minnesota wrote about $75 million of direct medical malpractice premiums. They had payouts, direct losses of $47 million. It is the single most profitable line of insurance in Minnesota. And we are the lowest in the country. We are lower than every state that has a cap. We are lower than any state for ER, OBGYN, general surgery. We have the best deal in the country. We had a witness come in and testify on medical malpractice and what he said is that what you're talking about in Minnesota is some of these reforms it's like living in North Dakota and going to New York State and asking them what they can do about their crime. We have the best in the country right now, and we should acknowledge that. And we think that that section, section 11, page 27, this goes in the opposite direction.
Okay. Excuse me, just a minute or two.
You know, we don't have any particular problems now to answer questions about that. I can tell you, one of the few times I agree with Mr. Renner, most of that information is already...
it's a great country, isn't it? We can have equal opportunity. I have to go to Ways and Means. We're going to meet tomorrow at 4:30 and continue this. If you thought of something you wanted to bring up, members, if you have amendments you want to bring forward, we're going to work on this this week anyway, so it's... You know, if there's something that's technical, we'll be talking about it. We, you know, we're going to have a, I mean, we'll take votes on things, but if you have copies, at least you should get to Jason by 2 o'clock, I think, to get amendments on the brain so people can get copies just for the processing. But we're not going to do 24-hour rules, I don't think.
Oh, okay. I want
to we'll have a we'll just have a reasonable rule. So if you can get Jason enough copies to go around, how many copies do you have? Like 50 or something? 45. So like 40, 50 copies of your amendment. Get it to Jason by 2 o'clock so we can just get it trans-trafficked around.
Are you going to accept short
order? Today?
No, the day of the same day. 2 o'clock tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Which draft do you want us to amend?
Actually, we're going to be working off the 053994, which is going to be introduced today as a bill. And you know, delete things, and so we may vote, we may not, but we may look at it and say, let's work on this a little bit more, and it's going to be, I think, a friendly process. We're not going to do, I don't want a lot of 5-4 votes and those kinds of things. If it's a bad idea, we'll just kind of abandon it. If it's a good idea, we'll try to fix it up. If everybody hates it but me, then I guess that's the end of that idea, you know? Yeah.
Are we going to be allowed, like, short oral amendments in committee?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're trying to get a consensus draft if that could be done. It's an experiment, members, and members of the audience. So Mr. Carlson still gets to talk, and I apologize that for leave, but if you do want to testify, please talk to Jason so this can be something to expect. And I appreciate that. So.
Any representative currently has a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson, you said that the last payouts was $47 million. So that must be newer data from a new year. The last time I remember was about $20 million. So instead of a tenth of the 1% of the healthcare dollar in Minnesota, we're spending 2/10.
Mr. Chairman,
for payouts?
Mr. Chairman, as representative, we believe that that's correct, and I just got that information last Friday, and it was a report done by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So that is where the $27 million figure came from, and the $20 million figure before that. So it's consistent.
Yeah. If you could get us that information,
I can, Mr. Chairman, and. Two significant cases in 2003 that were, one of which involves a booked in 2003 that involves an EMT, which is about $11 million case. Skews that number a little bit. You get one case that's that significant and skews the numbers.
Any other? Yeah, Representative Paul.
I'll defend my bill just a bit here. When it comes to a targeted defendant, we have targeted defendants now, and it's the defendant that's not covered under municipal liability, like the police and fire and governmental EMS are. So, as it stands right now, the only agency or the only provider on the scene that really isn't protected well are private EMS companies. That's number one. I don't want to belabor this, but the other thing is that we did have testimony that said that their insurance companies had told them that they would have significant savings on their rates if this law were to pass. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman and members, I did follow up on that. The suggestion that their rates would be reduced were the bill 651 to become law, and you need to remember that that statement was based on not being subject to the $300,000 cap. That statement was, are we subject to Chapter 466, which includes all, not just the cap, but all of the governmental immunities that are attended to 466. That would have maybe brought down their rates. But as to just having a $300,000 cap, I'd ask insurance companies to come up here and say, we will reduce their rates, their premiums, 20%. That I don't believe that's going to happen, and that reduction was only based on having them be subject to Chapter 466, which includes not just the cap, but all of the immunities that went with it.
Perhaps we could get a response on that. Yeah, if you have that information.
I don't think there's a specific answer.
Okay. All right. My recollection from being reminded in the past is that the insurance industry has testified that with some of these caps, you're actually, that those savings wouldn't be passed on just as a result of caps. But that's, you know, last year's testimony. So I'm not sure if that's changed in the interim. We have 1 minute to go. I don't think anybody wants to testify in 1 minute unless anybody else has questions for this witness.
Mr. Chairman, I would just add that the Congressional Budget Office, the General Accounting Office, and a number of insurance rating services have also looked at tort reform and medical liability, and it has not been shown to reduce any malpractice premiums. Happy to provide those to the committee.
Thank you. I guess we'll continue this tomorrow. We're adjourned.